You are listening to the Julie Parker Practice Success Podcast, where you discover management insights and strategies for a successful dental practice. There are also interviews with key people in the industry who have advice and services to help you and your team achieve great success. Welcome to this episode of the Julie Parker Practice Success Podcast. And today I'm joined by a resident legal advisory firm, Burke & Associates Lawyers, here in Victoria in a suburb of Armidale. And we've got one of the principal lawyers with us today, Megan Warren, for the first of hopefully many appearances. Welcome, Megan.
Thanks, Julie. Thanks so much for having me.
That's an absolute pleasure. And our topic today, I think, is going to be a really crucial one for many practices out there. Mm-hmm. And it is all around the complexities and the solutions that can be offered in terms of employing a dentist. And I'll tell you a little bit about my history and my knowledge around the area, Megan, and then you can share your wonderful insights. But tell us just a little bit about yourself and your firm, Megan.
Great, thanks, Julie. So our firm, Burke & Associates, we're based in Armidale. Around 20 of us now, including our lawyers and our support team, paralegals. Our practice areas are commercial business, commercial disputes, property, and wills and estates. We have a core focus in terms of, one of the core focuses of our practice is clients in the medical and health industry. So it could be individual professionals like dentists or doctors, or it could be, you know, private practices, or we do have a lot of sort of entrepreneurial clients too, who are not necessarily qualified in that space, but are really interested in things like health tech and bringing health into kind of the virtual world, particularly since COVID and the lockdowns, and looking at alternative ways to deliver healthcare. So that's us. I mean, our clients are all over Australia. Just because we're in Armidale, it's not necessarily that we have a huge pocket of clients in Armidale. They're really all over Australia. And I'm admitted to practice in New York in the States as well. So that brings a bit of an international element to our practice too, which is exciting and you know, a bit of a value add for some of our commercial clients.
Lovely. Did you spend some time in New York?
So I did too, to sit the exam. I haven't practiced in New York before. That was sort of something that I was pretty keen to do following getting my qualification there. But it was, I think, so I was admitted in sort of May 2019, and then COVID happened. So I'm sort of, you know, just like there are many, I guess, entrepreneurs in the health space looking for different ways to deliver health virtually, we've also been looking at, okay, well, you know, how can we deliver our services in a more holistic and sort of international way rather than me actually being there or going there or that sort of thing. So, yeah.
Certainly with all of the online stuff that's been prompted by the COVID situation, we're so used to it now. We wouldn't want to do it any other way in some instances, because it removes all the travel time and the harassment time of appointment times. And so it's a very efficient way, a very effective way as well of taking on the services of somebody. And as you say, you don't need to be in Victoria to be able to latch on to your fantastic legal firm. You can be anywhere in Australia and, in fact, even extending out to New York as well.
That's right. That's right.
So what I wanted to talk about today was something that is key for a couple of clients of late for me, but it's something that's always intrigued me too, to make sure that I'm delivering the right guidance. And I know that at the very start, I'm sure you would be saying, I'm sure you want to say at some point today that this is not legal advice at all that's being offered on this podcast. It's just for general information only.
Yeah, that's right, Julie. So it shouldn't be any information that I'm giving shouldn't necessarily be applied to your own personal circumstances. Best to sort of just take it as general information and always get in touch with us or your usual professional advisors if you need to sort of apply it to your own circumstances. Yeah,
fantastic. So I think because of the COVID situation as well, and partial and full lockdowns and everything, especially here in Victoria, now more so in Queensland, New South Wales as well, but really anywhere in Australia, I think the employment contracts of all employees, we've jumped head on into that.
because we really needed to know how we manage employment when we've closed our doors for certain periods of time. But separate to that is how we actually employ dentists themselves. Now, I've been in the dental industry, you know, forever and a day. And when I first started back in the 80s, the kind of common thing was you get a dentist on board, they get a percentage of their receipts that they generate from their invoices, and that's the end of it. And they come in, they wear your uniform and they abide by your policies. They attend staff meetings and team training as well, because the team training was always going to hopefully increase their hourly output as well. And everyone wins. And it was just an accepted norm. Then when I purchased my practice in 2003, yes, I was 33, I went to a lawyer and said, this is the way I want to employ the dentist. And even then it was like, sure, let's go ahead and do that. The one thing that was a bit separate to what I'd been used to as an observer on how practices employed dentists was when I said, oh, a restraint of trade post-employment of 5 years for 5 kilometres. And at the time, the lawyer said to me, that will never fly. That's a restraint of trade. You can't do that. So that was the big adjustment that I made. I said, what about 1K for 1 year? And he said, it still won't fly, but you might as well put it in.
Yeah.
If it makes you feel better.
Yeah.
But it was still kind of a contractor, an independent contractor arrangement. It was still kind of okay. But then as the years have gone by, it seems like that was never, from the ATO's perspective, the way they wanted dental practices to employ dentists. Is that correct?
Yeah. So it's not just the ATO, I suppose. Pretty much every regulator has a view about this for their own, you know, given the laws that they're regulating. So, and I think even just in your explanation, there's a number of different legal concepts or legal relationships coming up in that. So employment and then the independent contracting, they're two very, very different types of relationships. So the issues, I suppose, that at a high level are that the law essentially, no matter what you call a relationship in practice, no matter what the agreement says, no matter what you think it is, the law will essentially deem an employment relationship to exist if certain factors are inherent in the relationship.
So regardless of whatever you've stated in any kind of agreement, the external bodies will come in and say, but what you're actually doing indicates this relationship.
Yeah, if it does sort of tick off a number of factors, and the issue as well is that there's a big long list of factors that the law essentially looks at in terms of whether there's an employment relationship that exists, and there's no exact science around, okay, well, if you tick two out of these lists, then it's an employee. It's not. It's a balancing act, essentially, that's done by the regulator or by a court if the matter ends up coming before a court. So it's really tricky, and it's something that we caution clients in the both dentists and any client really in the medical and health industry who are looking not to employ a professional. They're looking for some other way usually for liability purposes, to protect themselves if there's some sort of negligence or, you know, patient complaint or something like that. So essentially it's something that I'd really caution people about doing without advice, because it's fraught with danger. I guess, would it be helpful if I talk through some of the consequences of getting it wrong?
Yeah, absolutely, because that's the stuff that will likely keep people awake.
Like the horror.
I'm getting in there and getting my contracts right.
the horror story, or, you know, the worst case scenario, which lawyers always love to talk about. So if we look at an example of a practice that thinks they're doing everything right, they think they're independently contracting correctly with the dentist, they're not employees, they're running their own business within the practice, and that's what they believe it to be, and they call it that in the agreement and things. But if, for example, they're not, they're sort of in substance, it is actually an employment relationship for a number of reasons. Things that can adverse sort of consequences are things like, so payroll tax, potentially payroll tax won't have been paid by the practice for these dentists, so there can be, you know, payroll tax audit and then potentially back payment of payroll tax and penalties and interest. So that's the state revenue office, state revenue offices. It's not the ATO necessarily. PAYG, this is the ATO, PAYG withholding obligations. So again, if tax, income tax hasn't been withheld on payments to dentists, then there could be back payments, penalties, interest. Superannuation guarantee contributions, which is the ATO, again, back payment and penalties and interest there if it hasn't been paid for dentists, unpaid annual leave and personal leave entitlements. There could be issues around work cover, so workers' compensation insurance, whether that has or hasn't been paid by the practice for the dentist. And there are also in the Fair Work Act, which is a separate, again, a separate regulator in terms of the Fair Work Commission, there are what's called sham contracting provisions. So these are almost, well, essentially penalty provisions. So, and it can be, could be, you know, the dentist that's complaining to the Fair Work Commission, or it could be, we've had sort of just an anonymous, I say in quotes, someone related to the dentist sort of making a complaint to the Fair Work Commission, and then the Fair Work Ombudsman can look into it themselves, look into the practice themselves. So these are, this is really where, you know, essentially it's an attempt, they have an issue with attempts to disguise an employment relationship as an independent contracting relationship. And there's quite severe penalties. So it can be up to, I think it's 66,000 at the moment for corporations and about 13,000 for individuals in terms of breach. And that's usually the practice owner, essentially, that's in trouble there. So
in addition to making sure you then do back payroll checks, back POIG, back superannuation guarantee, etc.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, there's three different regulators involved there. So it's been when we've had issues with clients who, you know, usually have come to us because, you know, not previously clients of ours, but they've come to us because they're the subject of an ATO audit or something on these. It's usually only one regulator that we're dealing with. I've never seen a situation where all three are kind of going after the practice at the same time. It just depends on the circumstances of which the complaint's sort of been made. But it's not, it's very stressful for the practice and can be very expensive. And even if it's just one dentist that has maybe made a complaint to the ATO about it, the ATO will then obviously look at the whole situation in terms of the practice, and that can be pretty expensive for the client in terms of the history there. So
yeah. And for younger dental practice owners that may be growing to the point where they're going to be starting to employ other dentists, can you, I know that there's probably a lot of complexity with this, but what are the big key points that makes an employee and an independent contractor an independent contractor?
Yeah, so these are essentially some of the factors that to be aware of. So one of the biggest ones, and I'll call them, I suppose, employee deeming factors, so those sort of factors that the law really relies on in terms of deeming an employment relationship to exist. One of the biggest ones is control. So control essentially over how the dentist is performing their work. So if the host practice is trying to tell them how to do their job, essentially when to do it, how to do it, perhaps getting them to comply with certain policies and procedures about how they do their profession, if you like, that's a big factor in terms of employment existing. Another one is so essentially around the hours of work. So employees usually have a sort of standard or sort of reoccurring set hours and things, and especially where the host practice is sort of saying we require you to work on X days, rather than allowing the dentist to be a bit more of a free agent and, you know, essentially running their own show. So in terms of sort of tools and equipment and things, employers will generally provide all of the equipment, all of the tools that an employee might need in performing the work. So whereas independent contractors will, you know, usually bring along some of those items with them themselves. Risk as well. So if essentially an employee usually has no personal or sort of financial risk or liability with respect to the actual business of the host practice, that is that the employer usually wears that risk. Another large one is so the right to delegate. So employees usually don't have that right. They're not allowed to sort of allow anybody else to perform the role, whereas if you were an independent contractor, maybe you wouldn't be able to provide dental services on one day, so you should be free to arrange for another obviously qualified dentist to fulfill that role. So those are, I mean, one of the, I guess I'll say smaller ones, but I have seen it sort of placed a fair bit of emphasis on it by regulators is the one you mentioned, Julie, around uniform. So I've seen the ATO, essentially that's been the tipping point. Like there's been a number of factors that they've analysed and then they've said, okay, well, you know, you required this practitioner to wear a uniform. And so that to us indicates that they're an employee. Like I've seen that sort of just be the straw that breaks the camel's back, even though it might seem like quite a small item. Essentially it shows that you're wanting to incorporate this person into your business, you know, represent them as being part of the practice, you know, and working for the practice. Whereas if they were truly an independent contractor or truly running their own business and they were just, say, licensing a room or an area to do that, they wouldn't be wearing the host practice's uniform, essentially. So
yeah, and it seems to be there's additional stuff to the list that kind of has been accumulating in my brain through conversations that I've had.
Yeah.
But generally the expectation of a dentist coming and working, I don't want to say the word employed by because there's legally talking about it now, but if you've got a dentist that you have come into your practice, you know, every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday from 9 to 5, they turn up to the team meetings, they wear your uniform, they are there for the morning huddle before any of the patients get seen, they are on your website as one of the dentists as part of your practice, their letterhead is the practice letterhead, not their own independent letterhead. I've even heard that if, you know, if they're not an employee and if they're an independent contractor, maybe they need to have their own fee list that they're charging as well. And if they didn't turn up to work, they certainly wouldn't be sending their buddy or another dentist in their place. And any holiday leave, sick leave, all those sort of, oh, sorry, not sick leave, but any holiday leave or long service leave, that would be done under negotiation as if they were an employee.
Mm.
But all of these factors are indicating that they really are an employee and they're not being treated as an independent contractor. And I would say a vast majority are not bringing their tools to work, any kind of tool to work.
Yeah. And that's the careful balancing act that you have to go through with each client and each practice is having that conversation of, look, what do you want to be able to do and not do in this relationship? Going through each of those factors and how they plan to operate the practice. If they're sort of ticking off all the employee boxes, I mean, we need to say to them, well, look, it's likely that they're going to be deemed to be an employee at law if you're wanting to do things like, you know, set their hours, negotiate some sort of quasi annual leave, long service leave, but not really referring to it as that in the agreement, you know, those sorts of things. It's just too dangerous. I mean, you've got to really, for practices that understand the difference and that are very comfortable with, no, you know, that's, we're not going to be providing any sort of leave, you know, that's a matter for them, you know, they're running their own business. There are some practices who are very comfortable with that approach and there are others that just aren't. So we have to make that assessment of what's most appropriate for you. That's the super important part that we need to do, the conversation we need to have with the client initially.
Yeah. So is employing the way we've been employing decades in the past, maybe not currently, I haven't owned a practice for a number of years now, but I've certainly consulted at many, The old-fashioned framework doesn't work. We can't deem them as an independent contractor. What's the alternative if we don't want to go down the employee path? Mm-hmm. Because we can go down the employee path, put them on the national award minimum hourly rate, and calculate all of their sick leave, annual leave, public holidays, all the rest of it. And my younger sister, who is a magnificent bookkeeper, and I came up with an Excel formulated calculator that worked all this out. So if under an independent contractor environment, you would normally have paid this dentist 38%. Mm-hmm. Then you enter in how many hours they work, what their average hourly rate is, and it spits out down the bottom. When you take into consideration all of the other expenses that you are going to be out of pocket as a practice to employ this person, this is the new percentage you need to charge. The employee dentist ends up with the same amount of money eventually if they do take their sick leave, holiday leave, all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. But it's such a nuanced calculator that you need to really update it every year, because there's going to be different series of public holidays. The minute they increase their hourly rate or decrease their hourly rate, it's going to affect the ultimate percentage. And if they increase the number of sessions they work, that's going to affect the ultimate percentage too. And we did that as a way of creating a space where that people could employ the dentists, but it's so got such complexity around it that it's kind of unusable. So what are the alternatives?
So from our perspective, there's really one alternative that works in terms of, and it, again, it doesn't avoid all of the risk, because you can never avoid all of the risk that it will still, there will still be deemed to be an employment relationship by a regulator, particularly when the regulators, I mean, their role is to raise revenue. So it's always going to be in their interest to deem an employment relationship. But essentially, the only way that we've seen that it works in a way that there's sort of less risk, or, you know, I won't say it's safe, but it's the safest approach, is where there's essentially the practitioner is licensing a space, you know, similar to not it's not a lease or not a rent, not paying rent. It's a license, essentially a license to use the space of the practice, whether it's a room or a chair in a room or whatever it is. And they're then also obtaining services, administrative and management services from the host practice. So the relationship is that the practitioner is paying the host practice. It is not that the host practice is ever paying the practitioner for anything. So that it's a very different, you know, and essentially it is just a commercial relationship between two parties, that the dentist operates their own independent business. They may operate it from one practice. They may have a similar agreement with another practice too. And they need to be able to actually operate their practice. They do need a space to do that, to license things. They may need to license use of a chair. They may need assistance with reception support and booking patients and billing and things like that. So things that are quite high overhead costs for an individual dentist to have to pay for themselves. You know, they don't actually want to set up their own practice with a number of dentists. They want to just be able to come and go as they please and see their own patients and things. So that's really the only way that we've seen that it works, and it has to be very well understood by the host practice and the individual practitioner that it's that this is the way it needs to work. Both, you know, yes, we can draft this agreement, which we're very comfortable with, but you actually have to do what the agreement says in practice, and you actually have to understand that they are a free agent. You can't be treating them like an employee. You can't, you know, you might have meetings where you need people to, you know, the team to be there, but you've got to be very careful about, you know, forcing the practitioner to attend these meetings or the sort of things that you're raising in those meetings as well. I mean, if it's really about trying to integrate the dentist into the business and sort of getting them to fly the flag for the host practice and things like that, that's inherently not the nature of what they're doing there. They're running their own independent business. So that just sometimes doesn't work for some host practices. They just don't want that sort of model, and that's fine, but it's really the only way that we see that it works in a way that minimises risk as much as possible.
And that kind of, that group of contracts, are they the service facility contracts? What's the right term I should be using?
Well, I mean, people call these things different things, and I don't love labels, because it's not so much what you label it to be, it's, you know, what's in there, what's in the agreement. But ours are called service and license agreements. So essentially it's, and that service and license talks about the services and the licenses being provided by the host practice to the practitioner, not the other way around. You'll see these agreements framed as the practitioner providing service to the host practice, or providing service to patients of the practice and things. That's not right. There have been a number of cases, I say recently, but probably over the last probably a few years now, they're a couple of years old. But that was, you know, and the courts had different approaches in both of them, and they were looking at different things in both of them. I'm thinking of there's an optometrist case, and there's a dentist case as well that I'm thinking of. But I mean, essentially the courts had different approaches, but one of the things that they both said was around the services, you know, was the dentist providing services to the host practice or to the host practice's patients or business, rather than it being the dentist's own individual practice and having their own patients and things like that. That was something that was quite critical to the courts in terms of making decisions on that, and ultimately, you know, finding that they were employees, or, you know, close enough to employees to have this particular revenue to be paid. So
with this kind of agreement, does it, with no guarantees, of course, we can't remove all risk, as you said before, will this kind of agreement more so reduce or mitigate the risk of, if anything ever went to court, having that payroll tax penalty, the POIG, the superannuation guarantee, all of those penalties, or the back pay of those things?
Yes.
Will this be a better option if people don't want to go down the employment path?
Exactly. I mean, it's, as you say, you can't limit all risk, but essentially this type of relationship and the way that we recommend it be recorded is the least risky approach in that, and if it is actually appropriate, you know, and this is the important point, if it is actually appropriate to what the parties are going to do in practice, it's not just about, oh, okay, well, we've got this agreement and so we're all good now. It's not about that. It's, we can prepare this agreement and say to the client, look, this is the way it should work. Is that appropriate for you and what you either do in your practice now, or with a few tweaks, you could easily do this? Yes. And if the answer is yes, and we also provide advice on all the different factors, making sure that in practice they are doing, you know, what they should be doing for this type of relationship, and it's not employee indicators. So the advice paired with that document then covers off the form of the relationship, which is the agreement, and then the substance of the relationship, which is what's happening between the parties in practice. So doing those things right together, hand in hand, and, you know, we see that it works really well for clients, and we haven't had any issues with clients being audited and in any adverse consequences if they're doing things in that sort of right way. The only time we've seen it not work well is where usually they haven't been clients of ours previously, and they've got sort of an agreement that's a mix of contractor, it's a mix of employee. Sometimes it's a mix of those things and a tenancy relationship, sort of picking all of these different relationships, and then what they're doing in practice is sometimes something quite different. So that's just when they run into issues, I think. So
what are the drawbacks of having this kind of service agreement service and license agreement? I imagine that one of the things would be you can invite people along to the team meeting, you can invite people to wear the company uniform, you can invite people to be involved on the website. However, there's no compulsion for that dentist to be so. Is that correct?
So the uniform point, it might seem like a small point, I would just steer away from that completely. So the independent dentist should not be wearing the host practices uniform. I just wouldn't do it. I think it's too, I've seen it, the ATO put a lot of emphasis on it, and it's just not something that I think would be, I think it's too risky an approach.
It's like putting that label on their forehead.
Yeah, I mean, it just inherently shows that they're not running their own practice. There's, you know, it is, the intention of the host practice is more to build a business that where the host practice is the one providing dental services rather than the dentist being the one that provides the dental services. In terms of practice meetings, and this is the thing, each of these individual things have to be looked at very carefully in terms of the substance of what's proposed. So the practice meetings, what's the purpose of those meetings? You know, what's going to be discussed at those meetings? I certainly wouldn't make it a requirement, as you say, for the dentist to attend, but it may be, you know, as many more a facility meeting. So if it's, you know, an invitation for users of the facility to attend to talk about, you know, issues they might have with the services, improvements that could be provided in certain, again, this is about the services that the host practice is providing, rather than sort of things like, oh, look, we require all dentists to treat their patients in X way and perhaps provide this sort of treatment, you know, instead of this sort of treatment. Those sorts of things are not, that will then come into that control test and trying to control how the dentist is providing their services. So that's a bit of it depends what the substance of the meeting is about, yeah.
And how about patient ownership? You know, who owns that goodwill?
Yeah. Well, no one really owns patients. Like, I guess that's the high-level answer to that question. And this applies really across the board with health and medical clients, is the relationship between patient and their practitioner is a very, you know, personal one. It's a fiduciary one, so, you know, very similar to the client and lawyer relationship as well. It's not a situation where anyone owns that relationship. It's a free choice. You know, the patient could continue to see that dentist or change their mind tomorrow and go somewhere else and see that dentist. So I guess that's got to be understood by both parties at the outset. So this is where a lot of practices will get into trouble with trying to police that relationship and sort of, and the restraints, you know, in that way that you talked about, Julie. So trying to essentially say, okay, well, you know, you've provided services to practitioners at our premises. We don't want you to provide services to those patients for a year or whatever it is following the time that you leave or within a certain radius, those sorts of things. Restraints like that, again, they don't sit with a relationship where it's two independent contracting parties and the dentist is running their own practice. So it's another big employee relationship indicator. If the practice is trying to do that and, you know, introducing restraints into their agreement with the practice and sort of trying to say, oh, look, you know, host practice, we own the patients, you know, you're not to sort of treat them following when you leave here. Yeah, it's an employment indicator more than an independent contracting relationship.
Yeah, so in a worst-case scenario, I think we were talking about worst-case scenarios before, yes. You may have a service and license agreement with a dentist that's been there for 10 years and once, if that dentist decided to leave and open up five doors down and appeal to all of their patients that they had been seeing, there's nothing to stop them from doing that.
That's right. If the practice is wanting to structure things that way in terms of a service and license agreement and they're two independent parties, yeah, that's right. It would be, and that's something that the host practice has to consider as well, is look, would they be okay with that? Is that something that is appropriate for them in terms of the relationship? But yeah, that's right. They can do that because essentially they're running their own practice and the patients are able, I mean, there are issues with the, this is probably a whole other podcast, but there are issues with restraints, you know, the enforceability of restraints at law sort of generally, whether it's in an employment relationship, whether it's in a sale of business contract, you know, where the enforceability will depend on where it sits in terms of the nature of the relationship and whether any consideration has been or money has been paid for the restraint. But there are also issues with the enforceability of restraints in particularly in the health and medical space and in that patient space where it is the patient's free choice. So what place is there for a commercial relationship to try to restrain? This is a public interest argument essentially, but what place is there for a commercial relationship to restrain a relationship between a host, you know, between a medical or dental practitioner and their patient? I'm sure the patient wouldn't appreciate, you know, that sort of restraint being put on their free choice. So there is a there are a few arguments there around the enforceability. So I don't love restraints in the health sort of context. There is a place for them, as I say, in these essentially a sale of business type scenario. So where a practitioner might be paid a sizable sum, you know, $1 million for their practice and all their goodwill and their practice that they've built up over time. And essentially part of that purchase price, that $1 million, for example, that the purchaser is paying is that they will have the benefit of all of these goodwills going forward. So there is a place for it there, but if it's more in an employment relationship and more trying to restrain the individual dentist from their patient relationships, it doesn't sit all that well.
Yeah, so from an accounting perspective, an evaluation perspective, it is an asset. The goodwill is an asset. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what control you have over that goodwill, it should be quite minimal.
Yeah, it just depends in what context, I think. So in that sale of business sort of scenario where there is a significant amount being paid by one party for something like goodwill, which, you know, essentially there is a place for it there, and courts do enforce restraints in that scenario because of the bargain. You know, it's really wanting the parties to have the benefit of the bargain that they've made.
And maintaining the value of that sale price, correct?
That's right. So that's, and it's ultimately the amount, you know, of that consideration that essentially the purchaser, but for this restraint, the purchaser probably wouldn't have gone through with the purchase. So it's usually quite critical to like a key term of that sort of contract. So that's why courts are quite open to it. But just sort of trying to restrain practitioners in their everyday, you know, sort of working life, and it's a different scenario. They're being remunerated, you know, they might be, if they're an employee dentist, they might be remunerated by way of their salary and things for their time in providing services. They're not being remunerated in exchange for providing a restraint and things. It's sort of this additional thing that gets tacked on that the dentist hasn't really been paid properly for a restraint on their professional practice like that. So, yeah.
I imagine that this kind of agreement, not employment, but agreement scenario challenge, is this the same in legal firms, in physio, chiro clinics, medicos?
Yeah, everywhere, every industry. It's I'll call them the common law employee tests. They apply across the board, across Australia to all sort of industries. So, and it's something that's it has, you know, as you say, sort of looking back in terms of history and, you know, whether this was very important, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Well, no, probably not. It's something that's really gained traction, particularly probably the last 8 years or so, 8 or 10 years. It's become more of a focus for regulators. And I think because there's so many businesses that aren't doing it right, to be frank.
It does come back down to protecting the people that need to be protected, the ones without power.
That's right. I mean, it's a daily, you know, daily for us in the practice that we'll get clients come to us and say, oh, I just want to engage this person as a contractor. And you sort of go, okay, well, what do you mean by that? Because every client has a sort of different view of what that means. And you have to really drill down into it and say, well, look, you know, what makes them a contractor in your eyes? Is it, you know, why, oh, we just, you know, one of them recently was, oh, this other party just wants to be able to claim sort of tax deductions as a contractor. And I sort of have to say, well, firstly, that's tax avoidance for the other party. But, you know, secondly, it's like it's about so much more than that. And it is a minefield because it's not, there's no sort of, okay, if you tick these four boxes, you're okay. It is a balancing act that each revenue raising authority and each court will go through, and you just see so many differing views about it that it's got to be done so carefully.
And I imagine that the kind of, to get it right for younger dental practice owners' minds, the independent contractor relationship works beautifully with a bookkeeper that may come in once every couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Someone like me, a consultant that comes in, and I may come in on a Tuesday or a Thursday or in a month, and I choose my own hours. We turn up in the whatever clothes we choose to turn up in. And if I wanted to be employed for my services by a dental practice three doors down, then the original practice has no say in that either.
That's
where the independent contractor arrangement, that's what it's designed to manage, yeah?
That's right. That's exactly what it's designed for, is if you think about it simply as these are just two separate businesses, you know, and if you take the example of you run your own separate business, host practice runs their own separate business, and there's an engagement there for you to deliver some value to them in exchange for something else. But you will also that afternoon probably have a meeting with another client that you might do a similar thing for. So that's really what the relationship is intended for, the independent contracting arrangement. So it's just, I think over time it's morphed into something else in a number of businesses, and the costs of getting it right and the consequences of getting it wrong are, they're a lot heavier now than I think they used to be, and regulators are a lot more active in this space in terms of auditing than they used to be as well. So, and you're right, it's for that reason that you know, it's really intended to protect where there are businesses doing it intentionally the wrong way, and there are people missing out on employment entitlements and over many, many years and things like that. And it's sort of something that they're doing quite systemically in their business. So, you know, everybody's a contractor, no one's an employee, you know, that sort of thing.
And I suggest if you're out there listening going, crips, I think I am doing it wrong. But I'm so far into it, I don't know what to do now.
Yeah.
I mean, what do they say? There's always two best times to tackle any issue. One was at the very start.
Yes.
Get more information at the very start, but that date's gone now. The very next best time is right now because, as you said, with every additional year that goes by, you're kind of digging yourself further and further into that hole.
Yeah, that's right. I think if there are any concerns about, I'm not really sure if I'm doing it right, or I'm definitely not doing it right, I would say pick up the phone, you know, contact us, speak to us about, you know, what should I do? You know, what are the sort of risks for me? Because it is at that point, it's a risk assessment exercise. And, you know, how do I mitigate that risk going forward? Or at least if I know how I should be doing things moving forward, I can start to maybe turn things around at this point. So, yeah, it's never a hopeless situation that, oh, no, you know, I've just been doing it wrong so many years, like I should just, you know, hope that nothing happens. Like, no, I think always get on the front foot and you know, have an initial discussion, and at least you'll know a little more about how, you know, where to go from there.
Fantastic. So we're going to wrap up because I've been so thankful for you've made this so very clear and wonderful. Thank you enormously.
I hope so. It's a minefield area, and so I hope I've been able to sort of give a bit of clarity around some of the points.
You certainly have. I think we all agree that the independent contractor, wipe that off the list. The choices are employee or some kind of service and license agreement.
Yeah.
And the employee path may be challenging because it's complex, and also depending on the level of understanding the employee dentist has, sometimes all they can see is I get a less percentage though in my current pay packet. So it's not just complex, but it requires some very keen understanding by the employee dentist for that to work well.
Yeah.
The service and license agreement would work very well moving forward when you're employing dentists over the next few months and years. And I would imagine, and this is a whole different podcast episode as well, but I just want to throw it out there. If you have got long-term dentists working with you and you really see them as part of the structure of the business, but you want to maintain restraint of trade, for example, some kind of restraint in there because they do now hold a big part of that goodwill with them, maybe the next best thing is to actually start to open up your practice to some sort of partnership agreement for these wonderful dentists that you want remaining with your practice long term, because it lends itself to the strength and the viability of your business and therefore adding enormous value.
I think that's right, Julie. That's and absolutely, it's another podcast, but it's so important, is that if there are, you know, dentists that are, you know, non-owners at the moment in your practice, and they are sort of critical to the value that you see in the practice and the patients and things, bringing them on as owners and bringing them on in circumstances where they would come on as owners, but it would be in exchange for a restraint being part of the deal as well. Yeah, you're going to have more enforceability luck in that sense with respect to restraints, rather than sort of just having them as employees and trying to enforce restraints in that relationship. Absolutely. And then that's all bringing more value to the practice as well. So
wonderful, wonderful. So if you're a dental practice out there and think, gosh, I need to get on top of this, what's the best next step for them, Megan?
I think best next step is to reach out to, you know, someone in our commercial team around medical and health. So either myself, George, who you had as a guest previously, Julie, Elizabeth, we're probably one of us is probably the best port of call. So you can just call anytime that suits or pop us an email. Our email and things are on the website. Email is sometimes good because it's something that can be done by the dentist after hours and things, which I know is better in terms of a busy practice day. But if we know in advance too, we can always schedule times to chat outside of hours, which we do a lot with clients in the medical and health industry because the day is so busy for them. So.
Fantastic. And obviously all of the website contact details for all the listeners are inside the show notes. So go straight to the show notes. You'll be able to get links to everything. And an ongoing offering that that your firm offers is to have a kind of a practice checkup in terms of documentation that George was talking about last time.
Yeah, that's right. A bit of a legal health check. And, you know, our law firms, we call it a practice too. So that's, you know, so we share something similar there with health practices. But absolutely. So it's essentially a checkup, if you like, on the business of a health practice. So making sure, you know, we prefer to do this in person because it's just more personable. We get to meet the owners, we get to meet the staff, we get to meet the independent professionals and see the practice. Not something that we can do at the moment in person because of COVID. So more Zoom and virtual still works well. But essentially going through, we have a bit of a list of questions to kind of get the conversation going around the business, its operations, compliance, sort of to get an understanding of really where the business is at and what assistance they might need. And then we will write to the practice afterwards, just setting out a bit of a summary of our meeting and what we see as being the priorities for them in terms of improving compliance from a legal perspective in their practice and sort of helping the business, you know, gearing it more for improvement in terms of operations and its sustainable health and things. So, yeah, so it's something that we offer to existing clients and new clients too. So, again, if you reach out to myself or George or Lizzie, we can tee up the time to come and do that for you.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so very much. We have got different, I always say we have two different types of goals in our life. The goal in this situation is compliance because it feels so good and it stops you from waking up in the middle of the night going, crips, I haven't looked after these things properly. And the other goal is the anti-goal, the thing you want to run screaming from, which is the SRO, the ATO, Fair Work After Your Backside. So
yeah.
We've got strong motivation to get this right within our practices. Thank you, Megan. You've been an enormous help.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, Julie.
Hey, if you enjoyed listening to this episode, you should join the club. The club members receive an online lunch and learn every week where I share insights, systems, and strategies to improve the success of your practice. These lunch and learns could not be easier. They are recording, so you can watch them at a time that suits you. Members also have full access to the library of all of our past topics. It is a powerful and effective way to upskill your team. I hope to see you there.